Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we are still plugging away at the Constitution. And by my record, we're basically halfway through. And we've got Paul Venable. Let me reintroduce everybody to Paul. He's been on the show for most of the year. And he is the current chair of the Constitution Party in Missouri and a former advocate and teacher for the Constitution extraordinaire. And many things other than that. I just for the sake of brevity and content, we'll just move forward. Paul, are you there?
Well, thank you, GR. I'd like to add that maybe I'm not a former advocate of the Constitution. I still do. That's why I'm here with you.
Okay. former advocate / teacher. You're still a current advocate, but you just don't have. You're not teaching classes anymore.
The clamor for classes is amazing. We're going to start teaching classes again. So hopefully that's good news for the people here in Missouri.
Excellent. Well, there's no better way to teach the Constitution than going through it line by line and helping people understand what parts are being violated or what parts aren't. And actually, what we just read, and we ended in the last episode, we read an amendment that was presented by James Madison and Congress to the states that had not been ratified. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't get a chance to dive into this and why unratified amendments are important. And so, folks, what we just went through was the reapportionment of how Congress was to be reapportioned moving forward. In other words, the Constitution, right there in Article 1, I think it's Section 2, or at the very top, it talks about how the initial House of Representatives would be apportioned, where we would have 30 people to one representative, not anymore. You're not to
30,
exceed
30,000.
I'm sorry. Thank you. And so it's still early in the morning for me, even though the show airs late in the evening. So we've got 30,000 for each representative. This amendment changes to where you go to 40,000 once you have 100 members in Congress. Once there's 100 seats taken up, then it goes to 40. Once it gets to 200, then it goes to 50,000. And so, and that's where it caps off, at 50,000. Now, the reason why it caps off at 50,000 was the framers were very honest men. And they knew that you could not be represented by one person. When it comes to a Republican form of government, we're not talking about a president, because a president is not a representative. A president is, at least in our Constitution, the one who faithfully executes the laws that our representatives create. And so the beauty about a representative government is that it is to be robust, in other words, large enough to actually properly represent the people, and that is what its at least the House of Representatives, that's its primary job, is to represent the people. Mm-hmm. So if you start actually allowing 100,000 to be represented by one person, you literally water down the voice of representation. And so when we look at, and actually, because I've talked about this on my Feedback Friday, when you look at the one person, one vote and improving representation, and how the Supreme Court in its, I'll just say what is the megalomania approach in trying to literally wipe out the representation within a state. What it should have done was it basically should have actually stepped back and said, you know, the Constitution only allows for 30,000 in the House of Representatives. And, you know, we see these problems in the state. We should actually write a recommendation to Congress to get in line with the Constitution. Mm-hmm. But instead, they felt it was more important because they were a progressive court. The Warren Court was a very progressive court. And the Warren Court decided to change the Republican form of government into a democracy instead of into the Republican form of government that was modeled after the federal Constitution. And so, anyway, I mean, the other thing is, why didn't they basically do the same thing to states? If their one vote, one principle, or one person, one vote principle was so sacred, then how come they didn't apply that to the states and say, you know what, it doesn't matter. Okay. It doesn't matter. States aren't sovereign anymore. It's about the people.
Right.
And you probably would have seen, you know, all of this, many of the states stand up and go, who do you think you are? This is absolutely bad behavior. And it, as far as we're concerned, you're gone. You can't rewrite the Constitution. But yet they got away with rewriting state constitutions. And they do not have that authority. Anyway, so there's my monologue for the morning and or the day. And so let's pick up where we left off. This next article is actually the 27th Amendment. Technically, in our book, it's the 28th.
Oh, real quick, let me ask you a question.
Sure, go ahead.
All right, before you get away. So this non-ratified article, can you tell me, if you remember, how many states actually voted for this? Because I don't think there's an expiration date on this one.
No, there is not. Just like the next one, there was no expiration date, and it was submitted in 1789, and it was ratified in 1992. So this very first one can still be ratified. There are 11 states that have ratified it, and many people think, we only need so many, and as far as I'm concerned, what we need, because I'm okay with saying we need to get it to 38 because we got 50 states in the union right now. So what that means is we need 27. We need 27 states to stand up. Now,
27 more states.
I believe that we can find 27 red states to do this. I believe that can happen. And folks, if you actually ratify this, this would displace Congress out of D.C. It would get rid of all of the POGs, or what I would call the assistants, the staff that your congressperson has. In other words, they wouldn't be employers anymore. They would be your employee. And that's the way it should be. They should actually be representing you instead of having a bunch of people that they hire to buffer themselves from you.
Did you use the word POG? I've never heard that before. What is that?
Pogue, it's a derogatory term.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Fine. Okay.
So anyway, when we look at displacing the House of Representatives, because that would fundamentally, if we go by 30,000, what's in the Constitution currently, then we would have well over 7,000 members in Congress, or the House of Representatives. And if that's the case, then where would they meet? Well, they would have to meet in your state, and there's no reason why they can't telecommute, and there's no reason why that we can't look at the congressional districts and create satellites that would be either attached to a county office, like a county government center where your county commissioners meet, so they can have their own little office building that's right next to that. or and it shouldn't be big. It doesn't need to be these monolith expensive buildings. It could just be an office where they have the internet and, you know, and maybe a SCIF. If the responsibilities are there, I'm okay with making every single one of these things SCIFs. Because,
well, you know, the other, go ahead.
SCIF is that way you never know. You know, if you just go down the path of everything that possibly could be done, you know, has to be maintained, and you just kind of keep everything down to where the representative has a room that they can go to have secure conversations for intelligence purposes. You know, if they're debating what to, you know, going into war or what have you. And we have the technology to give them everything they can do so that when they go to work, they can, you know, represent you right there from your home, from your, you know, a local vicinity to where you can actually gather out there and petition them.
Well, guess what else is cool? We've only got 3,000 counties in the United States. You know what that means? It means that your representative is right there where the county commissioners can touch them and the people can touch them and get their attention.
And the state and your state legislator, if we go back to the actual configuration that the Supreme Court that I just complained about, you would be able to have your state legislature working there too. See, folks, why is it that your state legislature is capped? Well, the reason why they capped all of these things is because the arcane concept. This is a very archaic concept that, oh, we're going to limit government based on this, you know, old historical belief that this is how many people we would need to govern, you know, going so far into the future. Well, they knew that this wasn't a full snapshot of the potential growth of hundreds and hundreds of years. And so they cast into this die so many seats, 435 seats or 200 seats or whatever. And at your state legislature, there's no reason why this can't, especially with today's technology, this can't actually just be scuttled and say, you know what? Right. That's just, you know, mothball it. And say, this is how we used to be represented, where we were removed and where there, not that it was sterile, because it was just, it was based on necessity that these men needed to be in the same room. We don't need that anymore.
Right.
They don't need to be in the same room. And as a matter of fact, the people that they should be working with should be actually right there in their hometown, their constituents.
I think a lot.
Everybody listening to this all of a sudden, oh, and folks, I am here to tell you that the cost of government would go down dramatically because they can operate out of their own home. You know, they don't have to have a second home. They don't have to have, like I said, a whole bunch of people employed to keep you from getting to them.
Correct.
And those were the people I called pogues. But anyway, because as a matter of fact, if you really look, if you've ever watched the show The Swamp, that little documentary, The Swamp, you'll realize that the majority of all the staffers, they are permanent fixtures there. I mean, you may bring some of your staff with you, your critical staff, but most of the people are residents in D.C., and they're party players, and they're insiders. And what they do is they say, oh, well, this is how we do it. Yeah, the Constitution may say some of these things, but this is how it's really done. And folks, when you hear words like that, that is basically telling you that they're actually violating the Constitution for whatever purpose. If they call it expediency, no, it serves some other purpose. And it's all about control for them. Which is why we're seeing the problems that we see over this whole past year, just regarding, you know, a party leadership. We're strangled by the party in our government. And we have to start taking a stand against the parties. And the only way to do that is to basically merge all parties onto the Constitution. If you're a Democrat and you love the Constitution, you should demand constitutional compliance out of every Democrat. And that goes with every other politician of every other party. But nevertheless, we're here to go through the Bill of Rights, and we were just going to go through the Second Amendment that was provided to the states for ratification, which is not your right to bear arms. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, Paul.
It was this one.
So, Paul, you got it?
I got it.
Okay, let's go.
No law varying the compensation for the services of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened.
And that goes for senators as well. So, in other words, if a bill goes gets passed and there's going to be an increase in compensation, then that senator, who may have 4 years, they have to wait 4 years before they obtain that pay increase.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Period.
Yes, correct. And so, and interesting, and like you pointed out, this was proposed in 1789, and they ratified it in 1992. Now, I wonder, what was it, if you don't mind remembering, what was it that caused the states to pull this off the shelf after over 200 years?
Well, so it was a point of contention between a college professor and a student.
Really?
Look it up, folks. You'll be blown away what it took for this to happen. But a college professor, so this kid, I believe I don't remember exactly what happened, but I do know it was a contention between a student and a professor, and the student basically had this theory that, you know, this an amendment could be passed. And I don't think it was this particular amendment, but this student basically said, yeah, we could pass this amendment. And the professor just shot down this student. This was in the 1980s, that looking at all the different amendments that had been attempted, like the ERA and some other ones, it said, you know, there's no way. There's no way you can get an amendment passed anymore. Oh, okay. Well, I mean, because the last one was over voting, and unless you were going to allow dogs to vote, because, you know, or your pets, because everybody that has a pet, oh, yeah, I want my pet to vote. I mean, that's how ridiculous we can be when it comes to the right to vote, because we just give it away. Or, you know, anyway, I digress. The whole point was that this young student, you know, took the challenge and basically proved to that professor, who I think gave him a bad grade, that he could do this. And he actually grabbed this amendment and actually started calling people. And if you kind of read what he ended up doing, this one student was integral in getting this amendment passed in enough states to actually make it happen.
Wow. That's impressive.
And, you know, there were a few different pieces in play, but bottom line, you know, like, oh, well, you know, we want to start constraining Congress from being able to, you know, instantly gratify themselves with pay raises and so forth. Anyway, so there you go. There was some talk about Hillary Clinton becoming a senator and that type of stuff. I don't remember all of the different side discussions that were being thrown out there. But again, like I said, it was ratified in 1992. So,
okay.
There we go.
So,
okay.
So the First Amendment, I guess, is next.
The First Amendment, correct, which is actually the third, correct. And every part of this amendment is being violated.
Okay. So you ready?
Go ahead.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Okay, so where do we start?
Let's start at the beginning.
Okay, so right. How is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Actually, so let's just start off with Congress shall make no law.
Okay.
And so we just change that language to the federal government. Mm-hmm. And now you can actually say no government at all shall make any law. And then you have to highlight what very specifically what can, you know, what no government can do and what the federal government can't do, because there's two parts. There are two parts of the First Amendment that only pertain to the federal government. And so we have to dive into the 14th Amendment just for a quick second here. And so I'm going to the 14th Amendment, and in section one, the very second sentence, and we're going to take that very second sentence to the semicolon, and that is right there a clause called the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And this clause basically states, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Now, when we go up to the very First Amendment, because just keep it in mind, citizens, privileges, and immunities, is the a law respecting an establishment of religion denying a privilege or an immunity from a citizen? No. So in other words, the establishment of religion is only a restriction placed upon the federal government. A state could actually have, and at the time of the ratification of the 14th Amendment, there were several states that had state-sponsored churches. And the state-sponsored churches were providing compassionate services. Because at that point in time, welfare was not, you know, a part of the godless secular church state. And so these states allowed these churches to actually perform welfare, education, health care, and those types of services for their people, for their citizens. And so the problem was that they were... the way they were implemented, it gave these churches an advantage over other churches. Now, that's still not a denial of a privilege or an immunity. As long as the state was not creating a law that denied a person their right, because it's the following one, or prohibiting the free exercise of their religion. In other words, as long as the people have their free exercise of their own religion, then having an established religion for the state is not prohibited at all. The federal government was specifically prohibited, and this is because every state, like I said, in the union had their own church. And the one thing that they didn't want was they didn't want the federal government to say, hey, you knuckleheads, we're all going to join on this one church and deny everybody else their unique church affiliations and doctrines.
That's what they meant by an establishment of that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion.
No, but remember that the privileges and immunities applies to any privilege and immunity that is identified to a U.S. citizen. And where are those privileges and immunities written? Right here in the Constitution. So if it's a part of the Bill of Rights, then it could actually pertain to a U.S. citizen. And if it does, no state can make any law that denies or disparages that right or privilege or immunity. And folks, they called them privileges and immunities instead of just rights, because the Constitution did not deal with all rights. There were very specific rights that they thought that were so important that they gave a legal context to a privilege and immunity. In other words, the privilege doesn't necessarily mean that because they're granting you this, they're granting, in addition to the privilege, an immunity. In other words, you are going to be free from, we're going into break, of course, but you're going to be free from any type of persecution or any type of, you know, laws or what have you, that we can deny you that those privileges. You're immune from us being able to stop you. Anyway... Let us go into break. We will pick this back up after this promo. Thank you so much.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so if we actually took this one amendment and broke it into the segments so that it was very, very clear, then Congress shall make no law, and then you just have everything here. And then you'd basically take this exact same amendment and then duplicate it and then say, no state or any government within the United States shall make a law respecting or prohibiting the free exercise of religion, because that's what it starts off with. And then thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people to assemble, so forth and so on. Now, but right here, there's one word that actually is a hot button. Press. So what is the press? See, when a state, and almost every state in the union, has further defined, more so than the federal government ever did, further defined the freedom of speech or of the press as the same, that every person had the right of freedom of speech and of the press, that the press was the people. Therefore, that the freedom of the press was extended to the people and the people alone. Is a corporation like the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times the people?
No.
No. Now, okay.
They may say that they may bring up the corporate person thing, okay, and therefore say that this entity, because it's a corporate person, has a freedom of speech.
So when they redefine something, right? Because they actually defined what a citizen was in the very, very beginning, and that citizen was a person born, not a corporation. When they actually included a corporation as a person, technically that requires an amendment to redefine what a person is.
Great. Thank you for clarifying
that. Okay. So there, what they did was they basically went roundabout by using the 16th Amendment to say we can tax corporations because that's considered income. Because it didn't say persons. The 16th Amendment said the tax is the source of income. And then it was the Supreme Court that basically said, well, corporations have income just like people. Ergo, we consider the corporations like people. And they granted that. They couldn't do that because, bottom line, they had to make an amendment to do that. To redefine a person into a corporation. Right. Go ahead.
There are also a couple of court cases in which railroads got away with being defined as persons, and following from that, corporations have been treated as persons with rights. But you have pointed out correctly that if they want to redefine this, then they've got to make an amendment.
So. Yeah, and if you look at those cases, almost every time I look at the case, we're going to find that there was, they had to really, really stretch the doors and the threshold of that door for the court to get that thing in jurisdiction wise. In other words, they basically violated jurisdiction of the court, because nowhere where I can actually see in the Constitution where corporations are arising under the Constitution.
Correct. Right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Correct. Okay. Right. So when we look at the particular case, I mean, it's one thing to say like Plessy v. Ferguson, where an individual's rights were being violated, and the, mm-hmm. the outcome of that case should have been that that company, that railroad company, cannot violate the privileges or immunities of any U.S. citizen, that the equal protection under the law means that mm-hmm. any person can sit in any chair on that train. You cannot separate those. But what Correct. They did was they said separate but equal. Well, okay, that required an amendment to the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. If they're going to redefine something that was defined in the very beginning, clearly defined in the debates in Congress regarding the amendment, this is what this means. And they say, no, if we're going to actually make it so it means this now, then they actually have to go and get the states to buy into that.
Great.
Because they've been making it up as they go along, and this isn't kindergarten play yard law. This is fundamental contract law. You have to have the parties buy into what you're doing. And they felt, you know what, we don't need to bother them. We are the high almighty, the omnipotent Supreme Court.
Well, thanks for letting us take that diversion. Now what we want to do is get back to defining the press.
Okay, right? So yes. So the press in every state constitution really defines and breaks down the press as the people, which means that it doesn't touch or doesn't mention the platform. Which means that any person can go and get a printer and print their own stuff and hand it out. Now, when all of a sudden you have somebody that says, hey, I have a super printer, and if you write stuff and you give it to me, we'll put it on our stuff and actually print it out. I'm not actually, these aren't my articles, they're your articles, and we're going to create a centralized paper or centralized medium for everybody to come and read all these views and so forth. Now we actually have a middleman, and this is what we call a platform. So every television, radio host, you know, anybody that's editorializing or reporting the news, you know, they're basically taking the individual and they're allowing it to be free. Now, when we look at the state, folks, this is not a reach. This is what the federal court should have actually done, and they failed to do this. When you look at, you know, the news itself, and as it comes forth and it gets consolidated into a press or into a platform, and the platform decides to only print very specific types of articles. In other words, they tell you, the writer, that we want you to go after this angle. Then that's not the freedom of your expressions. That is actually an assertion and a manipulation of what they want to present. Mm-hmm. Now, there's nowhere in the Constitution that the state can allow that type of control or that type of manipulation to be considered protected speech. Mm-hmm. In other words, that's not protected speech. That's not your free speech to say what you want to say. You are actually doing the bidding for somebody else. And so this is where the states can actually step in and say, look, no platform, if you consider yourself to be quote unquote the press, then the only thing you can do to take somebody's story is to edit it for grammar or punctuation. You cannot change the context or the content of that story. If you do, then you're considered a propaganda mill because you're filtering. And as far as we're concerned, that's destructive to the freedom of exchange of ideas and thought.
Mm-hmm.
Folks, your state can actually start going after Twitter. Your state can actually sue Facebook for every time that they have silenced you, because when they've created a law, they are a platform. And when they enforce a law that inhibits other than decency, if it's a public use and there are decency laws, which there are in every state in the union, pornography should not be permitted. And they should have decency standards. But, so language, clean it up, folks. Quit using expletives. But you start writing good, clean, from the heart types of articles and or comments, and then turn to your state and start demanding a lawsuit. Demanding that the state sue them for inhibiting and prohibiting your speech. Because you in your state as a person and as a press, the freedom of speech and of the press, you can be held accountable for libel. If Facebook wants to sue you for libel, that's on them. And they can make their case in court. But no state can make or enforce any law that abridges this. And when a corporation that is operating in your state under the license of that state, and they're actually getting away with this, this is basically the state underhandedly allowing your rights to be taken away from you, which means that you have a right to petition your state and demand your rights of freedom of expression. This is why we use petitions, not lawsuits. And this is what wakes up your state government in actually going after and regulating the media platforms.
Correct. It is awesome. And we correct. Speech is the people's speech.
Right.
And when a corporation wants to control that speech, then that's being regulated, especially by a state. If a state licensed entity is controlling your speech, then it is violating the First Amendment.
Right.
Because it has been sanctioned by the state, correct?
Yeah. So let's get into the very next one, because this will actually, now we'll shine some light on the next part of the First Amendment, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble. Well, where can you have the right to peaceably assemble? Do you have the right, because the streets is public property. Do you have the right to peaceably assemble? No, there are laws that actually deny that, because that is an avenue of commerce. And you get out and hinder commerce, you're denying other people their right.
That is why, and people not understand that is why that, if you want to have an assembly on a public street, you have to ask for a permit. They have those.
Yes.
Okay. And people, and I know people have said, why do I have to ask for permit to protest? Well, first of all, protest is not part of the First Amendment. Protests can get out of hand.
Right.
Protests can be controlled. But to assemble, if you're going to assemble in front of street, then what they have to do so that commerce can continue or whatever, they've got to have some kind of permit so it's known what you have in mind, and people who have the right to do business can figure something out or still do their business. And I never understood that.
Yeah, so it's because you just hit the threshold. So does the city have the right to basically say, because if you do business on Main Street, But Main Street is the one place that the city basically says, we're going to close this down for protests, parades. You know, if you process a license, this is the area we will give you. Okay, so do they really have the authority based on the Constitution to take away the rights of commerce for those people who will be adversely affected from that shutting down for that parade and or, you know, however many times a year that they have to be shut down?
No, they don't.
That's right, they don't. They actually don't have that right. These concepts of actually having parades and so forth, I believe that any business owner who is actually paying rent and working and paying the taxes of this city and or of a city, and they say, we're going to close down this street in front of you so and behind you or wherever where you get your shipments so that you can actually do your job, we're going to affect you by doing this, then I believe that that business has, I think, an open door to say, then you must compensate me, because let's go down this path of the, you know, the Fifth Amendment. No private property shall be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, I don't want to say that every business is private, because it's not, because it's registered with the state. But it is private revenue. It is private investment. It is, you know, it is for the public, but there's this fine line. And when you all of a sudden affect the bottom line of a business as a city or as a state or a county, and you say, we're shutting down, okay, it's, you know, there are costs like road repair, those types of things you have to do. But when it is for something to appease the people, I'm sorry, you know, that you need to actually create either a reception area, especially because let's get back to really what we're here for and what we have to do. When we look at the First Amendment, the right of the right of peaceable assembly cannot be denied. Well, what is the point of this assembly? If the point of this assembly is to come together so that the people can have an open forum to discuss the issues so that, you know, they're talking amongst themselves, then there needs to be places for this. Whether the city accounts for that by saying, you know, the park is a place to do that. Is the city obligated to necessarily build something for that? Not really. But they can't just say that they can deny you other than the fact that you can, as long as your rights don't violate or take away the rights of others. Technically, if you have a stadium in your city and the parking lot is closed off, you could actually say that they, you know what, we don't care that you have a, you know, a gate around your parking lot. That parking lot needs to be open for the people so that they can assemble there and be able to meet when you're not having a game.
Or here's one. You think the people have the right to assembly at Congress?
Yes, they do. And well, all of D.C., you got to remember, all of D.C. is government property. Right? All of D.C. is government property.
Right.
And if they allow businesses to be there for the public, that's the key word right there, folks. When that stadium is built, if that stadium is only built for members, in other words, you have to be a season ticket holder to be able to go onto those premises, then that is a private institution. But if it's open, so, you know, they want to sell tickets and have events for anybody and everybody in the community, and people traveling from the world around to come and attend the events in this venue, then that is a public venue because it's open to the public. This goes down that case where you actually, what is it, Plumbers or starts with a P. You know, I'm bad with names, Paul. Okay. I got your name right. It's that it's that case where the kids were protesting in California.
Oh, you mean Prune Yard Shopping Center?
Prune Yard Shopping. That's right, folks. When you really look at that, and even though they talk and point to the state constitution, don't forget that the 14th Amendment actually forces every state constitution to be the same. And when you deal with lawyers today, they say, oh, well, we don't see the 14th Amendment that way. Well, you know what? That's how it was sold. That's the only reason that the 14th Amendment has become so problematic and actually has been a tool worked against us is because the courts and government and everybody else has been redefining it for you. Mm-hmm. We need to actually dive into what the 14th Amendment really does and what its intent was. Its intent was to ensure that we all had an equal, you know, playing field, that everybody's rights, everybody's privileges were protected, that the U.S. citizen, you know, anybody that's considered a U.S. citizen, you know, has unlimited status in America. In other words, they can't abridge your ability to do anything. And when we go through this, I think, you know, you're going to find this is going to be an eye-opener because, you know, you're going to realize that the 14th Amendment created citizens not only out of the blacks, out of the slaves that were just freed, it created citizens out of the Indians as well. All Native Americans at that point that were a part of an Indian reservation or, you know, were, you know, controlled somehow by this unconstitutional Department of Interior, not that the Congress could actually control it, or actually Congress couldn't control it. I'm on kind of thin ice here. But the reality is that everybody that they had some form of control and regulating – they basically made them citizens because the 14th Amendment made anybody under the jurisdiction of the United States a U.S. citizen. So the only people, I mean, you had to be born here as well. That's the whole point. You had to be born here while you're under the jurisdiction. And so that it basically the intent was to make every black person a, you know, that it was born in slavery, that they didn't just get off a boat, but actually had been here for generations. They were all U.S. citizens from that point on. And the same thing with every Indian that had been living and residing within the boundaries of the United States.
Sure.
Now, can they have dual citizenship? Absolutely. But they had the rights and privileges of a U.S. citizen. And when we go through the debates, they're actually going to talk about Indians and all of that. Anyway, and they tried to restipulate it, but based on the original definition, they realized it did mean Indians. There you go. So anyway, we'll get into all of that.
So we don't mean Indians from India.
No, we don't. The Native American Indians.
Right.
Correct.
Right. Got it.
Okay. So the last part of this, right, the last part of this is the right of petition.
Okay.
And the right of petition for the redress of grievances, petitioning government for the redress of grievances.
Right.
In other words, it basically says that you cannot abridge the right for petitioning government for the redress of grievances. Abridge means diminish, take away, you know, lessen in any degree. And you were going there, but we didn't get a chance to really dive into this. But when Washington, D.C. is the capital of the United States, any and all U.S. citizens have and are entitled to unattested access to all public space. In other words, Congress can make no law denying our right to be able to petition government for the redress of grievances. In other words, every government vestige, every bastion of government needs to have, at least at a minimum, a reception area. So Congress, the building, the Capitol building, needs to have an area that will receive so that every individual can petition their government. And every office, government office from local city, local counties, whatever, all the way up to the Capitol should have the ability and a door or a reception area for people to basically petition them for the redress of grievances.
Mm-hmm.
And that right there is not a protest. That is a constitutionally protected right. The point of assembly is for everybody to get their ducks in a row so that we all understand what we need to do so that we can start signing petitions and start moving forward and getting into government's grill and saying, hey, look, you can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple, folks. They protected our self-government right of actually governing ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
These people, that just because they're elected does not make them special. It makes them fully accountable to the law and to us. If they don't want to be our servants, then step down now.
Right?
Sorry. Maybe I'm being I'm being a little bit harsh. But anyway.
Well, look at our circumstances. We're in harsh circumstances, GR.
Yes.
It's probably about time somebody spoke, not just somebody, you're doing it, but that a lot more of us got the message that you were trying to share and maybe get harsh.
Get in their grill, like I said.
Sure. So, it looks like we might have time, GR, to go into Amendment 2. I don't know.
This is actually more to this than meets the eye. But let's go ahead.
Okay.
We'll cover it, and then we'll dive into it in our next episode. Go ahead.
Okay. So Amendment 2. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Okay.
There is so much to this.
Right. So the foundation of your right to bear arms, you're bearing arms for many reasons, but the reason it is a constitutional reason is set up in this very first part of the clause, that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Why was this necessary? Because this is integral to Article 1, Section 8.
Mm-hmm.
Article 1, Section 8 basically states that Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia. And this is right there in the, I think it's subsection 14, yeah. To provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. In other words, going back to the Second Amendment, okay?
Right.
Though a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. So this means that we need every person that's a citizen to be armed, to be able to execute the laws, to suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. In other words, we basically are fully dependent upon you, and this is why you must be armed, and this is why the right of the people to keep arms cannot be infringed. And so we'll dive more into this tomorrow. I think, you know, that really covers the top part of this. And so, because we need to get into the state laws and those types of things that are, you know, tied to all of this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.